Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, my special guest is Hetty Einzig. Hetty is an old colleague and friend of mine. We've been hanging out with each other for a long time, working on some training events together. So I'm delighted to have you here, Hetty. Hetty's career has spanned the arts, journalism, media, the health sector. She designs and delivers global culture change programs and is a successful author. Today, we're going to talk about transpersonal coaching, and Hetty's special focus is on transpersonal coaching. She runs courses on transpersonal coaching, and she also specializes on women's issues. Hetty brings to this frame a psychoanalytic and ecosystemic frame, and I'm proud to say that Hetty is also an ANC certified coach. Hetty, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you doing today?
Oh, thank you, Simon, for that warm introduction. I'm doing very well today. At last, the sun has come out, as it's meant to, in June. And I am honoured and proud and actually delighted to be having this conversation with you and to be part of the ANC community. It's a rich community.
It is indeed. And you've been a big part of that. Hetty, we're going to talk about transpersonal coaching. Yep. Can you say initially for our audience kind of a loose definition of what it means to you? What does transpersonal mean to you?
Yeah, that's a good way to begin, because it means different things to different people. I try and explain it, I think, quite simply. It's a broad school of psychology, if you like. Maslow put it at the top. He talked about five phases of psychology, and he put it as one of the sort of, not quite the last, integral was the last one. But it's a bit like moving beyond, at its essence, it's moving beyond the personal. It's the clue is in the name, isn't it? So it takes a more ecosystemic, let's say that at the very beginning, perspective, although the practitioners and creators, developers of the concept wouldn't have used that word at the time. And it goes beyond, through, above, beyond the individual. So it essentially sees the individual in their context, and as a cell and part of the wider whole. And the kind of school of transpersonal coaching that I'm rooted in is called psychosynthesis. Again, the clue's in the name. The idea is to try and synthesize and to bring together rather than analyze the constituent parts. And that was developed by a psychiatrist and thinker and wise man called Roberto Assagioli, who lived in Florence around about the turn of the last century and lived through two world wars and died around in the mid-70s. And he really developed a whole school that's very, very practical. You know, it brings spirituality into the everyday.
So does it transpersonal beyond? I mean, I always associate it with faith, with spirituality, beyond the kind of beyond the material. But can it mean something else? Can it mean the ecosystemic from a non-spiritual perspective, or does it mean spirituality?
Yeah, in a sense, we're going to the heart of the matter. You know, what does spirituality mean? And especially, what does it mean today? And I think it's like several words. They're up for definition. Mm-hmm. They're up for redefinition. A lot of narratives and a lot of definitions are being contested right now. Like, you know, the stories of empire that you and I would have grown up with are being challenged, contested. And in the same way, spirituality, I think, needs to be refreshed, redefined, regenerated to be relevant for our times. So one of the defining features of the transpersonal is, yes, it includes spirituality. But Assagioli was incredibly clear. He said it's got nothing to do with faith and religion. He said it's got everything to do with infusing the spirit. And he talked, you know, his definitions were things like, he said it's far from being theoretical, it's eminently revolutionary, it's dynamic, it's creative. It's for each of us to say, what does spirit mean for us today? And the big thing for me, which is why I started by saying it was ecosystemic, and it was really, it was a road to Damascus moment for me when I discovered the transpersonal on my training. It was the last module, you know, 3 years of study. And it was like, okay, I've come home, because it brings together poetry, beauty, art, politics, you know, it's a way of trying to make sense of everything. And the big thing that I think makes it so relevant for today is what Asa Joly said, is it replaces a more anthropocentric and individualistic way of being in the world with what he said. He called it a spiritual heliocentrism. And people always go, oh my God, what does that mean? And it means going around the sun. But we could say, I would replace that with saying an ecosystemic, going around the earth, putting our planet at the centre of things rather than our own individual concerns. So it kind of puts us in our place.
Yeah. And we need putting in our place.
I think we do. Yeah.
No, I mean, anthropomorphism and like the human-centred kind of way of thinking is so pervasive. I mean, you know, you and I like try and think differently, but actually I find myself still doing getting caught in it. Like because it's so pervasive, it's so much part of us, it's actually hard not to. And we've really got to kind of shake ourselves up, haven't we?
Totally, all the time. And I mean, you know, we are all being shaken and stirred, haven't we? I mean, we've had a series now. We've got in the backdrop, well, we've had the pandemic for 2 years, which has really made us realise how fragile life is. Yeah. And I think there's nothing like coming up close to death and disease to make us begin to appreciate what we have got. And, you know, everybody was going out and rediscovering parks and greenery and planet Earth. And then we've got this horrendous war, really horrific war in Ukraine, and not going to go into discussing that, but it's sort of like most of our my reaction to that was like, really? In 2022, can we not solve our differences in a slightly more mature, you know? And so I think all of this brings us back to, what does it mean to be alive today, living on this earth? What's our contribution? What do we have to do? What's the bigger picture? I mean, I think it was Frankl who said something like, don't ask what life can give you, but, you know, what can you give life? What is life demanding of you? And I think that all of those sort of things come into spirituality, don't they? You know, that it's sort of like, trying to cultivate the best of ourselves rather than understanding how awful we are as humans, you know, and the terrible damage we do.
And before we started the podcast, you said you'd like to ask me about my faith, and I'm going to jump in first and ask you about your.
Yeah, go for it. You're rotten. Okay, go for it.
What's your kind of faith journey? Which kind of
Well, I don't. I wasn't brought up. My mother was Jewish. She's dead now, and she came over as a refugee. So I was born with that sense of precariousness. She came over as a refugee on the Kinder transport, the children's transports from Berlin, from Germany. And lost most of her family in the Holocaust. And so, if you like, unconsciously, I wouldn't have been able to articulate this as a child, but, you know, that fragility was always there, that sense that life was precious. And she was not religious at all. She said, rather kind of dryly, you know, if that's what it means to be the chosen people, thank you very much, choose me out, you know, I don't want anything to do with that. So she was very anti-religious. But she found her sense of spirituality in thinkers and wise people like Krishnamurti, who was an Indian sage. I mean, you and I know him, but, you know, for those who don't, he was a wonderful thinker who was brought over and spoke very brilliantly and wrote very brilliantly and held, you know, meetings and things about how do we live a good life, if you like. And people like Aldous Huxley and you know, Bruno Bettelheim and Frankl and you know, Bertrand Russell, the sort of philosopher thinkers who took faith and said, it's not about dogma and it's not about following the rules of any particular religion. It is about taking the time and acquiring the discipline to think about, what does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to make a contribution? What are we here for? What's the part that we play in the cosmos? Yeah. Not, you know, moving from an anthropocentric, you know, if you look with hindsight and look through an ecosystemic lens, they were all saying it, all of what we're talking about, they were saying it differently, but they were saying it then, you know, and going right the way back. So it it helps you get a bigger picture. So I think I grew up with that, and I grew up with this idea of service. I grew up with the idea of looking after the weak and vulnerable, or caring for them. And not easy. You know, I'm not a naturally nice person. My husband's much nicer than I am, you know, much more caring. But it gives you, I think, the yearning to find meaning and purpose and to hold a bigger picture. And then when I discovered, as I said, the transpersonal on my, when I was studying, that was a big moment for me, because he, Issa Jolie, articulates it so generously, so beautifully, and gives you all these practical approaches, if you like, exercises, theories, models, that makes it very, very easy to say, oh, yeah. And then I wrote about it. What I did was I called it secular spirituality, a way to live it in. So that's a little bit about me. Now tell us about you, Simon.
My faith journey, I don't know, it's interesting. My mother was loosely a Christian. My mother got was a poor woman from the north, and she kind of escaped a difficult background and went to East End of London when she was 17 and got picked up by the Methodists, the social activist Methodists. They kind of picked her up, saved her soul, and looked after her, got her into college, educated her, and she always remembered that, and that was very important to her. And she taught in a church school when she went through college, and she became a teacher, and ended up as being the head of a beautiful kind of interfaith kind of a multicultural school in Bristol. But I didn't get church really. We went to kind of a few Sunday school lessons when we were kids, but that was about it really. And I grew up in a very strongly secular Bristol. I mean, all my friends, all my mates, everything was secular around me. And I'm kind of, they think I'm a weirdo, you know, because I want to go to cathedrals and mosques and things when we go off on trips. But I always, it's almost like I had a kind of calling to kind of go into these spiritual places. Like I'd be 18 and I'd be self-defined as an anarchist and God is dead. And kind of like, I actually kind of explored that idea quite deeply, that God was dead, and came to the decision actually that didn't make any sense. That just didn't really resonate at all with me. And it kind of left you like very kind of human-centric. It was like, it was all about us then. And that kind of didn't make any sense to me. And I also kind of experienced spiritualness in nature, in mosques, in Hindu temples, in Buddhist settings. And I went to, if there was kind of anything on offer, I was there. You know, I go to kind of Glastonbury Festival, and I'd be hanging out with the Hare Krishnas in the Krishna tent. You know, that all my mates would be kind of doing some drugs on the other end of the field, and I'd be kind of like chatting to Hare Krishna and talking to them about theology, like, you know. And so there's always that calling in me. And then in my mid-20s, I had a kind of, you know, we have these moments in our lives. I had a son unexpectedly. I was 26. I was a home parent on my own. I separated with his mother. We co-parented Finn, my boy. And I used to go to the Quaker meeting house in Chester for free biscuits, basically. It's kind of, I was like living on welfare. So it's kind of free biscuits. We find our way around. And when it was raining, we go in there. And I started reading their posters. And I thought, this is interesting. And no one ever pushed religion on me. Because if anyone pushed religion on me, I'd kind of fight against it. And kind of, I'd have some quite, you know, the idea that kind of Christianity had its own truth and Islam had its own truth. And it all seemed a bit paternalistic and a bit kind of dogmatic. And I kind of railed against kind of dogma and authoritarianism in any form, particularly in religion. But the Quakers didn't do that. They kind of just accepted you, and they said it's experiential and sort of really kind of there's that a God in everyone, and it's a peace church, and it was like, it's about equality. And it just aligned to a lot of things I kind of believed in at the time. And I liked the idea. I started going to kind of Quaker worship, and you sit in a circle and you sit in silence, and there's no priest. It's a priesthood of all believers. It's an egalitarian kind of system. And you wait for that of God to kind of arise up in you, and you actually do quake. You kind of like, you feel a shaking in your body, a physical kind of experience, and you find yourself standing up in a Quaker meeting house and ministering. You speak. So it was a very powerful. And then I started reading about the kind of early Quakers, and that took me on a journey into Christianity, because like the early Quakers were absolutely radical. I mean, what they did was amazing, like, you know, in terms of kind of they'd walk into church and they'd berate the priest for kind of being kind of authoritarian and teaching the wrong gospel, and the only gospel they believed in was a gospel they experienced. It is like what happened within you. And then they worked out a system for holding that. So they, if you believe that God is in us all and God speaks through us all, then of course that can be quite dangerous, because you always get some kind of eccentric characters who think God tells them to do kind of some crazy things, and the Quakers experienced that as well. So they got this beautiful system where they said, okay, so you test kind of your experience of God by your own experience, by the scriptures, and by the community. Mm-hmm. Really quite interesting. So the community kind of would
it's
kind
the
of,
check and balance, isn't
yeah,
it? The check and balance.
I've been going for like 350 years, you know. And it's quite moving. You go to Quaker business meetings, like in London, and there'd be like 600 kind of Quakers gathered together, making decision making through kind of spiritual consensus.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be voting. It'd be kind of everybody could wait under the Spirit to see if. They were guided by the Spirit or not. And it was like this idea of kind of spiritual consensus, this idea that there's something beyond us, something transpersonal, yeah. which kind of guides us, is really, really important. So that was my journey. And then I moved to Ireland, and there was only a very small Quaker presence here. And I got a little bit disillusioned by the Quakers, because they became so liberal progressive in a sort of a culture war sense, that they kind of almost abandoned faith or God. Not all of them, but a lot of them, you know. So you'd get Quaker Buddhists, Quaker pagans, Quaker this, Quaker that, and they kind of moved away from Christianity, they moved away from the scriptures, and God became a bit of a dirty word, and it became a very almost humanist gathering, which is kind of interesting. But you know, you get people ministering, standing up and saying, I listened to Radio 4 this morning, and I'm like, this is not what it's about. So, you know, so I have great time for the Quakers, and you know, they were active against slavery, penal reform. The things they did for a small kind of group was amazing. And I am still a Quaker. I'm still a member of the Lancaster Quaker meeting. I'm kind of still, and I find that kind of worship important. But I did move into kind of a mainstream kind of Anglican or Church of Ireland church. And I actually found symbolism, the sacrament important, taking the bread and wine, the kind of the singing. So I'm a member of the Church of Ireland and of the Quaker faith at the moment.
I think it's so interesting, so many parallels, the revolutionary spirit, you know. We tend to think of organized religions a little bit the way Marx thought about it, you know, that it's sort of opium for the masses and, you know, a way of keeping us quiet. And of course, it can be, and it often is in many societies, a form of social control. But it can equally be incredibly revolutionary and create what I think, you know, where the parallels come in with coaching and psychology and the language that we would use is it's a phenomenal container. And, you know, that's, of course, what the Quakers were doing. They create a really strong container which enables people to find what's important to say within them. And, of course, you're going to get some sort of mavericks and nutcases and people who are way out there and all right across the spectrum. But there's obviously something strong in the middle of it, because it wouldn't have survived so long, 350 years. And that courage to stand up against oppression is incredibly hard to do alone. And I think the kind of anthropocentric individualism that Western societies have particularly cultivated for, you know, centuries, really, and we can talk about, you know, you can go back to the Enlightenment or you can go further back, is an incredible burden. Because it means that every single day you've got to get up and craft your life. And we all know, you know, how hard that is, you know, not creating a spectrum of pain. You know, there's this sort of, there's a lot of anxiety and depression out there right now. And there always has been. And, you know, you can't measure it. You can't say there's more now than there was then. But it's certainly being talked about a lot more now than it was in, let's say, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago. People must have been unbelievably despairing of humankind during the period of the two world wars. And there was a lot of, you know, suicide, depression, anxiety, but it's not, wasn't talked about in quite the same way as it is now. And I think that if you're alone with that and you're somehow got this narrative which says, you know, you've got to kind of muscle up and sort it out and make choices and go for it, that's a tough call. Whereas one of the things that spirituality, feeling yourself to be part of something bigger, very much the way you described it, and I was similarly, would always be drawn to, you know, because I was brought up like that. You know, we didn't we went to cathedrals pursuing beauty and light and sound and space and all of that. And so, you know, never called it religious, but we were in sacred spaces. And you're right, whether it's a mosque or a cathedral, it doesn't matter very much. It's how you approach it and how you absorb it. When you are in those spaces, you feel held.
For a
moment, you step out of time, out of the kind of mess, chaos, dirtiness, ugliness of everyday life and that sort of anxiety. And for a moment, you can breathe and raise your spirits, raise your eyes to think about something a bit bigger. And I think that's why bringing the spirit back into coaching, bringing it in, to me, is very important right now, because people are looking to find ways to craft a narrative that has more meaning and purpose in a world that often feels like it's going to hell in a handbasket, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I think modernity has produced kind of a relentlessness towards sort of growth and instrumentalism and rationalization, as if it's, you know, there was a great excitement and faith when modernity kind of took the scientific turn, and it was exciting. Great things were happening, you know, great discoveries were being made, you know, whilst at the same time, people would be treated very inhumanely, you know, like in the massive kind of industries. And so there's that, always that duality of sort of science was providing great answers. And at the same time, it's producing kind of an inhumane kind of a knock-on effect. And it's like, you know, that's never been reconciled, you know, in our contemporary age with all the knowledge we have. You know, there's still kind of world hunger. There's still kind of like
totally.
Terrible kind of poverty and oppression in workplaces and stuff. So it's exactly why transpersonal coaching and transpersonal kind of thinking needs to kind of be embraced. Yeah.
Well, what it gives us is it gives us a language. It's really hard to talk about things like that. It's a little bit like, you know, it's hard to talk about love without sounding sort of slushy or like a sort of cheap greeting card. And in the same way, it's very hard to talk about spirituality without sounding a bit kind of like woo-woo or a bit kind of up there in the clouds and something. Yeah. But actually, it's very robust. And in terms of everyday life, it involves, you know, following your path, following the disciplines you've chosen for yourself to help you stay centered, help you rise above the petty concerns, and it helps us make more moral and ethical choices. And the very unfashionable words nowadays, morality and ethics, aren't they? You know, who talks about ethics, morality? But you look around us and people are suffering. They're deeply depressed by when we look at the governments around the world and what they're doing. And it's not just in the UK or the USA, it's all over. Their failure to step up to the plate and make the hard decisions that will enable people to live better lives, fairer lives, more equitable lives, and the hard decisions that are needed to support the big changes we need to make if we're going to have a planet at all. You know, we've got a sort of 8-10 year window. And I think that, you know, the spiritual disciplines, if you like, provide a kind of language. And transpersonal coaching, what Asa Joly did, which I think is hugely undervalued, and I want to kind of give a shout out, as it were, for it, is he provided an everyday language to talk about these things. So he would just talk about, he wouldn't talk about soul or spirit. He talked about the self with a capital S. Mm. And on his model, that lives on the boundary between the individual and the universal.
Yeah.
So that caused me to think a lot about indigenous ways of looking at the world and their rituals and practices and their way of looking at spirituality. And they would say, there's a lovely story about a man called Simon McBurney, who's an actor, and he was preparing a one-man show about a National Geographic photographer who got lost in the rainforest for, I don't know, several years or months, whatever it was, and lived with this tribe. And so McBurney went out there in order to prepare to talk to these people and to spend some time. And he asked them, he said, where do you locate consciousness? in yourselves. And he tapped his head and he tapped his chest to sort of give them an idea, or his gut or his solar plexus. And they looked at him very puzzled, and they roared with laughter and they waved at the rainforest. And he thought, oh, they haven't understood. They haven't understood. So he asked again, and he tapped again various bits of his body, and they went, you know, no, what are you talking about? Roared with laughter again. And they said, no, no, it's out there. And I think that when, you know, again, that's, that for me is a simple but very revolutionary idea, is that actually spirituality is us and out there. It's partly in us and it's mostly out there. It's how we relate, because we're porous, aren't we? We're constantly taking in each other's breath. I mean, that was big time in COVID. You know, that's hence the mask. Don't breathe other people's breathing. But we're doing it all the time. And breath is another word for soul or spirit, isn't it? I mean, so it's all meshed up. And I find that really useful way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, that connectivity is kind of what we have to regain. I mean, again, modernity was all about kind of reduction and breaking things down to small parts to understand better. Mm. You know? And again, you know, that was very important. But I think it's interesting that the kind of revolution, quantum physics and things are kind of actually aligning to kind of indigenous ways of thinking. They're aligning to kind of the idea of kind of like we're all part of the whole. It makes kind of more sense that from a scientific level as well as a kind of a transpersonal or spiritual level now, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally, totally. You know, I mean, things like, you know, mirror neurons was the beginning, really, where we really woke up to realise that everything you do, I'm you know, when you talk, and we mirror each other, we feel each other's emotions. And then things like polyvagal theory, where, you know, we co-regulate. You know, if you're in a state and you see a client, your client's going to pick it up, aren't they? You know, if you're wound up, all of that, and vice versa. And then this idea of of being interconnected. We talk about it a lot, but I don't know that we really feel it. And again, one of the things that that I like about transpersonal coaching is it offers us, it asks us to think about spirituality in different ways, and particularly in two ways. One is this idea of transcendence, which we've picked up big time in the West, this idea of overcoming difficulties, climbing to the top of the mountain, pursuing goals. Nothing wrong with that, but it's only one way to live. It's not the only way. And this other idea is immanence.
Yeah.
Is finding spirituality within. And that could be going to the heart of the mountain or into the cave or getting down into the soil. And people talk very, you know, very poetically, very elegiacally, you know, sort of inspiringly, don't they, about when they've... I was listening the other day to a program about new ways of farming. And there was a woman whose name I didn't catch, who was talking... It was a real spiritual awakening. When she rediscovered the land, she was an urban, grown-up urban, she rediscovered that. It was her spiritual conversion, if you like, and it was all about planting in the soil. So that's an imminent. And I think that's becoming more and more important today, is we're finding the spiritual in different places, much more in the earth and the land.
Very much so, yeah. And I think feminism and women's writing, I read Donna Haraway a lot. Women have really taken the lead on some of this, really in an exciting way, I think.
Totally.
Work out there, which is important.
Yeah, tell us more about Donna Haraway, because I'll chip in with a bit about Carol Gilligan, because I want her name to get in there as well.
Well, Donna Haraway is kind of probably my favourite thinker at the moment, in the sense that when I pick up her books, it's like they excite me. It's like, you know, a lot of stuff you read, it's kind of repackaged stuff from before and stuff, you know. And Donna Haraway is like, whoa, this is like, you know, this is challenging me. And she's very much into kind of understanding us as so interconnected. You know, she talks about there's no such thing as autopoiesis. Like we talk about autopoiesis as kind of self-managing systems and self-creating systems, you know.
Doesn't exist.
She says, no, it's sympoiesis, making with. We always make with another, you know. And she gives examples, you know, even our guts are full of microbes and stuff. We can't, we live with other, she calls them critters, other critters all the time. And we have to understand our kind of life with other critters. And she knocks aside the modernity argument and says, like, you know, yeah, progress and all that, that's all very fine. But it's really about kind of living with and being with, and it's about multi-species. And she's very much into kind of the entanglement of life, staying with the trouble, not finding quick solutions. And it's kind of got an ecological, but she also, you know, a feature, she also kind of entangled into that technology. So she wrote about cyborgs and stuff, not in a negative way. She's kind of really able to explore kind of these things as entanglements. Everything's an entanglement, and that's not kind of a good thing or a bad thing, but it's kind of how it is. And how do we live with entanglements? How do we live an entangled life? And it's like, you know, these ideas I think are really pertinent to kind of how we are and how we kind of get through this kind of phase of climate change, of transition from modernity into the next phase of kind of how we live on this planet with our fellow critters.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Robin Wall Kimmerer is sort of similar, isn't she? Where she talks about, and which spoke particularly to me because I was trained as a linguist. I studied languages at university, and she talks a lot about language and the use of the word it in Western languages as a way of objectifying. And therefore, it's easy if you think of a tree as an it, it's easy to take up a chainsaw and think. But if you thought of a maple tree as a her, yes, you might think a little bit twice, you know, because they live just like you and I do. And I found that, as you know, again, simple ideas, but they're revolutionary in the way they address our unthinkingness and our unconsciousness. And Carol Gilligan in the 80s did something similar. Another thing that we haven't really thought about, but which is, you know, anthropocentrism. Anthropos is man. And yeah. What Carol Gilligan pointed out, the unthought known, as you know, once again, what we all take for granted is all the models and psychological models that we live with and the theories were mostly 99% defined by men, mm-hmm, based on their observation of boys and men and the way they, yeah, behave and the choices they made and so on. And therefore, women are automatically deviant, mm-hmm, lesser than, you know, wrong. Yeah. And so she wrote a book called Different Voices in the 80s, where she simply, it was a longitudinal study, and she simply asked young girls from about the age of 13 right through to about the age of 30, so over a period of time, questions about what they thought about truth, morality, choice, will, questions like that. And it's absolutely riveting. And she just let them speak in their voices and then had a gloss. And from this developed this idea of the ethics of care. Mm-hmm. Because fundamentally what came through, the themes that come through, are from the way these women, and whether it's nature or nurture is a false debate, really, because it's obviously a bit of both. They kept saying, well, it depends, because it was all to do with the relationship. And as you said, the entanglement, the enmeshment of life. Yeah. And that these, particularly as young girls, when they were playing, their primary goal was to preserve the relationships and keep those healthy rather than follow the rules of the game. And so, you know, Piaget, the great god of learning, saw this as a deep failure. Women obviously have no legal sense. They're obviously incapable of, yeah, following rules, and they're never going to make, you know, they're never going to make organized society and, you know, deal, really. And if you turn that on its head, you have very interesting and thought-provoking ideas to deal with. And I mean, we've come a little bit far from the spirituality, but to bring that back, I think that when you have a framework that is spiritual or transpersonal, is the word I would use, it keeps reminding you, what is the ethical thing to do here? What is the beautiful thing to do? What is the thing that really is going to make sense? And take care.
Yeah.
Take care of our environment, take care. And so these, again, care is a word that needs regenerating, refreshing, reanimating, because it's so identified with, I don't know, care workers who get paid nothing, mothers who are too caring, or people who are too careful. I don't know, it's got a lot of bad press. Yeah. So yeah, I think there's some really actually quite revolutionary ideas that I would like to see brought into our coaching.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, one of the problems I have with spirituality and work, and I kind of write about this in my books, is how it becomes instrumentalized. And kind of what I mean by that is, I was talking to someone the other day who said their speciality was spiritual capital, and I kind of my jaw drops to the floor. Like, you got economic capital, you have kind of emotional.
How you monetize it? Yeah,
exactly, and that is how it's sold. You know, it's like, you know, if you do this in the workplace, you know, if you do mindfulness in the workplace, it will up performance by 20%, you know. And it's like, is so much missing a point. It kind of completely and utterly misses a point. You know, like as a byproduct of kind of creating healthy workplaces, for sure, things might be more successful. You know, let's kind of see what happens. But like, if you aim for it, if you set it as a goal, as a target, if you instrumentalize spirituality, you lose it immediately, as far as I'm concerned. I wonder what your thoughts were.
No, I completely agree, which is why I'm quite careful when I go into workplaces. I think there's two schools of thought, aren't there? And I kind of come and go on this. One is you go in and you do the best you can and you make a chink and you hope that something will grow. You know, you throw some seeds onto rough ground and you hope something will grow. Another school of thought, and I have colleagues and I know people who would say they just wouldn't go anywhere near, particularly the big corporates. And I think both are completely valid positions and I kind of swing back and forth. We're straying into politics really here. I mean, the language of performance, I think, is dead in the water personally. You can perform all you like. There's this lovely new acronym that's just hitting the mainstream now coined by a futurist called Hamais. I think it's Cascio. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Cascio. He's a South American. And it's Banny, B for Bertie, A-N-I. Actually, it's B for brittle. Brittle organisations, you know, and it's replacing VUCA. Post-pandemic, you know, very fragile. This sort of, you know, just-in-time kind of manufacturing makes there's no slack. There's no room to breathe. Yeah. There's no room to learn. There's no room to reflect. And there's no room there for resilience. So they're very brittle, isn't it? A for anxious, of course that makes us anxious, massive anxiety, we've talked about that. And the non-linear idea and the incomprehensible idea. And I think that, so I is for incomprehensible and N for non-linear, which goes beyond complex. It's basically saying you could make great effort and get little result, or you could make little effort and get great result. You could get results today, or you might have to wait 6 months, 2 years for results. You know, nothing is sort of cause and effect. That linear cause is dead in the water. And I think that that fragility means that a lot is changing in organisations right now, you know, with hybrid working and so on. So I think that there is room for a kind of spirituality like the Quakers went into organisations, you know, Clark's shoes, which will be very familiar to the Brits listening, but perhaps not to others. Cadbury's was a Quaker. Was it Fry's? I always forget which one it was. But, you know, it was spirituality in action, which was just like, it is our absolute fundamental duty to make sure this is a workplace where people can not just survive, but thrive and flourish. And that means bringing education in, bringing opportunities for leisure, taking care of, you know, that everybody's got something to eat. I mean, these basics aren't in place for a lot of people, not just in countries that we might still call developing, but actually here now in so-called advanced civilizations like the UK and the USA and Europe. There are people who cannot put bread on the table.
Yeah, I mean, in my theory of eco-leadership, one of the key four principles is organizational belonging. And that was to do with kind of being in so many workplaces where I felt people were so dislocated that they individually they didn't belong, but also the organizations became dislocated from their communities. So Cadbury's in Birmingham, they created kind of model villages, they created schools, they created a whole kind of ecosystem around the workplace, which kind of held the community. And they felt, you know, they made money, but they pumped it back into Birmingham, and you can see the effect of it today. Like, you know, and they transform kind of slums and things. And so many kind of organizations now are offshore, they don't belong. And what I write about is it's not just kind of the corporates ripping us off. It's actually they get ripped off, their workers get ripped off, because if you don't belong, you don't feel any connectedness, you don't feel any location yourself, you don't get any joy. You know, there's a joy in giving as well as a joy in receiving. And this is reciprocal, you know, this is something you get. And so many organizations are kind of deserts of love, deserts of kind of meaning, because they're dislocated, they're cut off, and you cannot kind of recover that. I mean, I work with a lot of senior leaders, that, you know, and coach them, and so much of my conversations actually turn to spirituality, not through me leading it, just because people start exploring a lack of meaning, you know, in their lives. You know,
exactly.
Very successful. They've had their heads down and they're like, you know, what's all this about?
You know, so, you know, you're saying exactly the same thing, aren't you? Or we're talking about the same thing is, do you then refuse to go into these organisations? Or do you say, I can at least bring space to reflect and explore meaning and so, I mean, it was from you actually that emphasis on place. I really picked that up when I was training with you and then working with you, and I've incorporated that very much in my work. It's so important, and I've written a chapter for a book that hopefully I think it's been published in the autumn. Call it, you know, radical hope, a dimension of the soul rooted. This idea of place. Where do we that doesn't mean, I mean, humans have travelled since time immemorial. In fact, we used to travel much, much more, according to a wonderful new book by anthropologists David Graeber and David Wengrow, called The Dawn of Civilization, where they turn it on its head and say, we used to be travellers all the time. We're actually much more rooted. But, you know, you travel, but you have that sense of belonging. They have that sense of place where you put down roots, where your relationships. And you're quite right. You know, the anomie, to use a word I like, the just feeling of dislocation, disconnection, what am I doing here, lack of meaning, I'm just pushing buttons. And that gets translated into mistakes, failures, and as you say, you know,
burnout, bad relationships,
bad relationships, you know what I mean? And I mean, the latest thing that to hit the headlines, isn't it, is the Great Resignation. And that's not people on 0 hours contracts, that's people working, for example, in healthcare or tech, particularly in tech, they're being paid very well in their 30s and 40s, and they're just leaving. Large numbers. So that's that search, that yearning for things like a space where I can be my best self, I can give. I think we get more joy from giving than from receiving, actually. And, you know, that place where we can actually find beauty. And I don't mean beauty in a sort of aesthetic, pretty way, but that real sense of beauty that you get, which is a deep relationship, being altruistic, being in service, being connected, all of those things. That's spirituality in the everyday, isn't it?
It is, and it's, you know, it's life-giving and it's life-saving. I mean, just to reflect again, through this conversation, you kind of sparked me about my own experience and you know, the things I left out was, I've also spent quite a lot of time at monasteries and I'm somebody who sort of claims I don't like a routine and, you know, I work for myself. I kind of do lots of creative things and that's great. So a monastery should be everything I hate. You know, it's kind of the most ordered kind of life you can think of on the surface. But what I discovered was absolute kind of a deep peace and a deep engagement there. And I you know, I was told I had a deep monk within, like, you know, and then they were encouraging me to join the monastery when I was there because it was there's something about it, and it's about behind this embeddedness, a kind of in place. They take vows of obedience, stability, and celibacy. And if you think about that, that's absolutely radical in our society. It's like the most radical opposite of what the rest of us are doing. You know, it's like, you know, the idea you stay in one place, the idea that you're obedient to kind of the prior or the head of the monastery. The idea of kind of, if not kind of sexual, these things are kind of absolutely radical. And it's kind of interesting. And then what spoke to me about that was the way this community takes the self and takes the kind of the individual kind of ego and offers it to the community. It's like, you know, The way this kind of idea of obedience works is like you take a vow of obedience, which means that, you know, you can't leave the monastery unless you're given permission. And yet I met kind of more kind of monks who are kind of have an anarchistic streak in them than you do in a kind of court.
They're more revolutionary.
They're revolutionary, they're radical. Like, you know, it kind of releases something, you know. If you give yourself kind of to the wider planet or to whatever cause, then it releases something which frees you up in a way which you can't get just through kind of chasing freedom directly.
So I really agree, and it makes me think what you just said, Simon. It makes me think of another unfashionable word, is sacrifice.
Yes.
You know, what someone once said to me, I was moaning about never having time to write and wanting to make more time to write, and he just said very simply, listened in a very beautiful way. There's a very spiritual person, this. And you can feel it, can't you? You feel a sort of glow from someone who's able to be still, just the way you describe those monks. And he said, what are you willing to sacrifice?
Yes.
To make space to write. And these monks, I mean, that's radical, because we live in cultures, you and I live in a culture which says, no, you can have it all. Spend, yes. spend, yes. You know, acquire, you know, it's, you know, lots of different sexual partners, lots of everything. And I don't know where that's led us. You know, as you keep reminding us, there's some good thing. Of course, there's a lot that's good about modernity. We're not saying let's all go back and be, you know, cavemen or you know, live in very primitive ways. On the contrary, I think it's about saying, what can we learn? Again and again, I come back to this idea of sacred spaces. You know, this chapter that I've written at the end, it was the hardest thing I've ever written, I tell you, to try and feel hope. You know, the war in Ukraine had just kicked off.
Yeah.
And I've got a lot, real sort of sense of, you know, I feel a lot of gloom about the planet, really, I do. And, you know, and it's not just my Jewish heritage. I think I share that gloom about the planet with a lot of people. And it was the hardest thing to write. And I kind of, where I came to is this reconnecting with this idea that soul and spirit live within us and without us. It's got to be about connecting with others. And that what we can do, perhaps in our community, is to create those sort of secular sacred spaces for dreaming together. And what it reminded me of, Simon, a lot was how we began every day of the training with that social dreaming.
Yes.
And, you know, who else does that? I mean, where else do people sit together and say, well, think, well, the other place is indigenous communities.
Yes.
That take dreams seriously and say, right, you know, for half an hour or an hour, we will sit, we will dream together. Mm. And this will help us reflect on where we're going to go to next. So to me, that's spirituality in action.
Yes, yeah. You know,
because fundamentally, that's what prayer is, isn't it? Prayer is the daily bread of all religions. Yeah. And what they're basically saying is structuring time to be still, to get rid of all the stuff, the must-dos and the must-buys and the blah, blah, blah. And let's just be still, reflect, and see what emerges. The principle of emergence. You know, you were talking about that with the Quakers. That principle, I mean, that is so not built into our culture. I don't know where people find who don't have a place for that, what they do.
And it's about, I think added to that, it really is that idea of kind of it being incarnational or kind of experientialist in our bodies is very important, like, you know, because people kind of they get cognitive about spirituality or faith, and they you can produce arguments for this or that, you know, and it's not about that. And the transpersonal work really takes you into kind of your body, your connectedness, into a different space, which is very different from kind of arguing whether God exists or not.
Oh, completely. It's not about how many angels can you find on a pinhead. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And of course that's a lot what people will get into if they're that way oriented. I've done quite a lot of, I've done yoga since I was 18, and I can't even remember how I got into it, but somehow I did. And somehow, without really thinking about it, it became my practice when I was at university. Yeah, yeah. So it was at uni I discovered it, and it wasn't trendy then, and not many people had heard about it. And I just did it every week, and it became that kind of thing. And it's only on reflection, looking back, I realised that was my going to church. You know, that was sort of spirituality. And then in later years, I've studied with quite a lot of body work, and it's too much to get into right now. But that thing of reconnecting with our own bodies through that symbiotic, that relationship, you know, that co-regulating, that, like you were saying, when the Quakers are all together, there's a vibe, isn't there? Yeah, I mean, you could sit on your own and you could reflect. Of course you can. But it's a different order of magnitude when you're sitting with 600 or even 20 people.
That's right.
It changes the breath in the room, I think.
I'd say this has been fascinating. We could go on and on. It's so interesting.
Yeah, we could, couldn't we?
I need to finish. I like to ask my guests two questions at the end. I guess you you might have heard this, but I want to ask you kind of what transpersonal kind of a living or coaching can help us to think about how we live a good life and to create a good society. If you've got any thoughts at all, just to share with our audience.
Gosh, it's a sort of great question, Simon. And I have heard you ask people, and people have given wonderful answers on your podcast. I think a lot of it's been said. I think, in a sense, I would say for me, that every time I come back to reading about the transpersonal, to teaching it, to practicing it, to using some of the techniques with my clients, a stillness and a recentering takes place in me. And it helps me make, I hope, better choices for the good of me, my family, my society, my colleagues, and ripple then outwards. I think until and unless we get this sense of connectedness, interconnectedness, and interdependence more than connection, then I'm afraid I'm not very hopeful for humankind. I think we may be in a process of winding down the Homo sapiens. Not so wise, not so sapiens. So I think that the transpersonal can be a way of recalibrating and reinvigorating our sense of, you know, humans are one niche of a complex ecosystem.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's what we have to offer. And we have great, yeah, there you go. Not a very articulate answer, but that's where I think the transpersonal really has a lot to offer in very practical ways, you know, this idea that we are an ecosystem inside as well.
Sure, sure. Hattie, that's been wonderful. Thank you very, very much for your sharing with us. And I hope to see you on the journey ahead. Just to let people know, on the show notes, Hattie will take you to her transpersonal coaching course. That would be very good. I'm also going to be doing some more work on this, because I agree with Hattie that kind of this is a work which needs to be done at this time. So thanks, Hattie, very much. Go well.
Thank you, Simon. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having a conversation, for inviting me, and go well yourself.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice, where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.